Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we talk with a guy who's into both kinds of music.
That's right, country and western.
Well, no, not exactly, but you'll see.
Very good.
All right. Okay, Patrick, we're going to do an interview today. We're going to play an interview today. I guess we've already recorded the interview, but we're going to play an interview today. We haven't done one in a while.
Yeah, it's been a little bit.
It's always great to talk to musicians. We really enjoy that. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And what you're going to hear is today's guest will be Robert Ellis Orrell. And if you're not familiar with that name, well, you should be, because he's a really interesting guy, and I think you're really going to be entertained by this interview. But just a quick rundown here. He has been a major label recording artist, you know, singer-songwriter type, worked in country and some other styles, and is, like I said, has been on major labels. He worked in Nashville for quite a while as a songwriter and wrote, like, hit country songs for other artists you may know.
Mm-hmm.
And then his career kind of changed gears, and he founded a independent record label in Nashville called Infinity Cat that really focused on like punk bands, right?
Amazing. Yeah, totally amazing. A guy after our own hearts in many ways. So, yeah.
It's really, really cool. It's a cool story. He's a really interesting guy. And one thing I'm going to tease, this is a two-part interview. So you're going to hear part one today, part two tomorrow. Tomorrow, he's going to talk about how he was somewhat instrumental in a certain country/pop star's big success. So you want to hear that.
And it is big.
It's big. So anyway, we met this guy once before, which is how this interview got set up. And you're going to hear about that at the beginning of this interview. Really interesting guy, don't you think, Patrick?
Oh, loved it. Yeah. And a man who can talk as much as I can. So it's going to be filled with a lot of cool insights, folks. Yeah, it's really, really good, and really appreciate his time. And just you know, he's one of us, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why we were talking with Robert is because he has a new solo album out that he recorded independently. This is not really a country record. This is more, I would say, more kind of like Brian Wilson-esque kind of pop music.
Very much.
And it's called 467 Surf and Gun Club. And there's a reason for that. He's going to explain that. And we talked with him from his home in Massachusetts, where he went back to his native Massachusetts, where he lives now. So, all right?
That's right.
All right. Yep. Let's kick it over to the interview now.
Press play.
We got a couple ribeyes hot on the fire, a case of Miller and a few fat tires, and I don't think we could get any higher here in our backyard. 467, that's the sign on the door. You can't come in unless you've been here before. We call it.
All right, so we welcome Robert Ellis Orrell to Rockin' the Suburbs. Robert, this is our new podcast. New meaning we've been doing it for like 4 years now, but new to you probably, because we were doing our old show called Dad Rock when we stopped by your place in Nashville a few years ago, the Infinity Cat House. So good to see you again.
The Cat House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here's the funny thing about that. Patrick will remember this. We went there to do an interview with Daddy Issues, the members of the band Daddy Issues, who we kind of we were on our way to South by Southwest. They were going to play there. We stopped in Nashville to do some other recording of our podcast, and that was a band we were interested in. We really liked their stuff, and we go there to the Cat House. We record an interview with them, and while everything was getting set up, and we were kind of waiting around, we meet Robert, and you know, we weren't prepared for this, and he has like a gold records hanging in the office, and we're like, well, I guess everybody in Nashville has gold records hanging in their office, right?
And I imagine I never shut up. once I opened my mouth.
So we were right at home with each other, Robert. I mean, and incredible too that Infinity Cat was such an influential punk label in Nashville, like corrupting the system from the inside, which I love, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was great. It was really memorable. And of course, Daddy Issues played a little live, you know, two or three songs for us and was amazing. So.
Yeah, love those kids, and geez, wish they'd make another record, but I don't know if that's going to happen. Kind of all scattered around and doing other things, but
yep.
Even if it's like, I consider that second album, because the first one was the cassette,
right?
And it was really crudely recorded, and but it had great songs on it, and then the second album was just amazing, and in every way, sonically as well, and. And if that's the only thing they leave behind, we were lucky to have it.
Yeah.
So
true. Yeah. Well said.
Okay. So Robert, speaking of Infinity Cat House, this all plays into your new solo album. So tell us the name of this album and how it relates to that experience.
Okay. Well, the name of the album is 467 Surf and Gun Club.
On the color TV, 'cause it's raining and we can't shoot our red riders. So what? That's what we always say, 'cause we still have the day. Warm gear and cold slides.
Way it relates to this house at 467 Humphrey Street is that was kind of our nickname for it after a while, because it felt like a neighborhood bar, because everyone was coming and going, and you never knew who was going to come in the back door. And we had these BB guns up on the wall, like three or four of them, and we had the tin cans hanging down from the trees, and we had a huge backyard, and we had a huge deck out back. And anytime you just got bored or you just want to take a break, you grab a BB gun and just shoot cans, which I had never done as a kid or anything. I'd never done it. And I think it was Jake, my son Jake, who had a BB gun, and I was like, oh, let me try. And I was like, this is so satisfying. When you hit a can, it's like ping. And so, yeah, that became a thing. And I don't know,
Didn't Elvis used to do that, like go shoot stuff when he needed a break?
Yeah, I think he really shot stuff.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, so he did.
But the 467 Surf and Gun Club was born when Jake and Jamin, my sons, who have a band called Jeff the Brotherhood, they were in Hawaii on a tour that Volcom sponsored, and they were kind of doing a documentary, and they were playing surfing events, sometimes on barges set out in the water. And and it reminded me of when my one whole third of my family, my cousins, Malcolm, Christine, and Frankie, grew up in Hawaii. And I remember I used to see these old surfing movies of them, you know, from the 70s and the 60s. And I was just like enthralled. And that's the one of two states I've never been to. And, you know, they would come to visit us in Boston area here. And I was just like surfing, because I just couldn't imagine that you could. Anyway, so I was feeling like nostalgic about that. And I was missing my kids. And I just started writing songs about 467 Surf and Gun Club as if it was a real place. And it started with a song called Morning Song.
Here I go again, rolling out of bed, long before the sun comes up. Opening my eyes, so I can see it rise, high above the town I love.
tell you, at the, I've had a career like almost 40. Well, yeah, I signed with RCA in 1980. So I've had a career, you know, including 5 years of trying before I got signed to a record deal. Good 45 years. And the as careers go, in terms of success or whatever you want to call that, it's a roller coaster. But I think the peak of my absolute happiness to go every day to a place was the Infinity Cat House.
Wow.
Just to go there. And I remember I was coming in the back door, and I unlocked the door, and the sun was just coming up over the horizon, because I used to get up really early because I couldn't wait to get there. And I wrote that song, Morning Song, almost in real time when I sat down as soon as I walked in the door. I was just feeling like super grateful about, I just super happy. And that's what kicked off the record.
Wow. Well, you know, I find this really intriguing about your career, which is that, you know, you worked for many years as a Nashville insider, right? I mean, you were songwriter for the Machinery.
I tried to stay inside, and I tried to stay a cog in the wheel for sure. I was a go to an office, at whether it be at, and songwriters tend to jump from publisher to publisher as soon as they get too deep in the hole. Steve Earle famously said, die unrecouped. But I went from, you know, Warner Chappell to BMG. I was at Zomba for a bit, Peer, EMI for 6 years. You know, you just show up at work and you write a song or two or three every day, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, because if you think about how many other people are doing that in town, there's like 2,000 songs being born every day. And then you try to get those on a record. And then if it gets on the record, that's a miracle. And then, oh my God, is this going to be a single? Because that's the only way I'm going to make any money. And yeah, it's crazy. It's nuts. But somehow it worked.
And Robert, I got to ask you too, when you have, you know, said a couple times, you know, I sit down to write a song. What instrument is it that you sit down at to do that?
It's the piano.
Okay. Okay.
It's that's where I know, that's where I can play any chord.
Okay.
If you get me on the guitar, and I can play about six of them, and you'd think I would be better at that. I started, you know, when I was like in like 11, but I just, my fingers hurt from pressing those strings down. So I just never, I kind of regret in a way that I just admire guitar players and how much like a voice the guitar is,
yeah,
you know, and how they can just like completely let what's going on in here and in here just like go through their fingers and come out through an amplifier. That's awesome. Yeah.
It's amazing, but I can totally understand, given your experience and your, you know, breadth of songwriting prowess, that you would sit down at, you know, the piano, where you have so many, like you said, so many more chords and so many more voicings. But
right,
I'm curious to know, what were the records when you were a kid, like in high school and all that, that inspired you? Like, what really got you turned on to being into music?
Okay, well, first off, I was definitely in the Beatles versus Monkees debate. I was Dave Clark 5. I was Dave Clark 5 for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other kids in the fifth grade were going, who? And, well, they were the last, whoever was last on Ed Sullivan, that's who I loved. But so the Beatles were the Beatles. It was all about I'm not going to start about the Beatles. Right, no one needs to know. Yeah. By the time I was in high school, my hero was definitely Todd Rundgren.
Oh, period. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so cool.
Todd Rundgren. So I bought a ballad. Runt, the Ballad of Todd Rundgren. Yep. That record.
Yep.
And then I, of course, got the other Runt record, and then I got the Naz records, and the one real record, and, you know, later the throwaway stuff, and then Todd. I have tickets for Todd in Boston in October.
No way.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I'm just like a Todd nut. But I will say that in the 80s, after I got my record deal and I got better tickets to the shows and got to go and meet some people, and he came to one of my shows once, and
Wow.
I started writing songs with this drummer, Willie Wilcox. Mm-hmm. Actually, my son Jamin, the drummer, and Jeff the Brotherhood is named after Willie's son, Jamin.
Wow.
Because I thought it was a cool name. So I called him up when we had that baby come and said, hey, what's that name mean? Anything, what is it? And he was like, I don't know. My wife made it up. And and we named Jamin, and he became a drummer too.
Wow.
So when it really came down to like into the 80s, well, let's prior to the 80s, 78, 79, it was then all of a sudden it was Elvis Costello and even more importantly, Nick Lowe.
Hmm.
Nick Lowe really taught me like a lesson about, I was like every songwriter, I think when they're, as they're growing as a songwriter, they feel like, you know, this is like so precious. I'm working the song and I've got a little notebook full of my songs. I still have my notebook full of songs from high school and they're all shit, but
yeah, they're not.
But good. But they're still all in a little bound notebook. And
yeah, I have one right up there.
Yeah.
It's like the composition book, right?
From exactly.
The grocery store. Yeah.
But Nick Lowe taught me that you could write about, you know, Mary Provost being eaten by her dogs, or that you could go in the studio with 20 songs and if one didn't work, you just kick it out and just go to the next one. And I don't know, yep. Just learned so much from him as a songwriter and a producer. And of course, Elvis fed into that. And his engineer was Roger Basharian, which is why Roger was my producer for albums 2 and 3, because I wanted to go to Rockfield Studios where Rockpile recorded. And I didn't even know about all the rest of the bands that, you know, were there. And and I made 2 albums at Rockfield. Yeah.
What was it about Rockpile that appealed to you so much?
Gosh, between Nick Lowe's consummate songwriting skills and cleverness and doing things I'd never heard before, like I love the sound of breaking glass. Like all of a sudden, I can do this. Okay, I don't have to do this, and then that. Like, and then Dave Edmunds, just sheer rock and roll, just I really hadn't been like that much of like a straight rock and roll guy, you know, more Beatles, you know, more Todd Rundgren.
Right.
Once in a while, Todd would rip one off or something, but
right, totally.
So yeah, between those two together, and then seeing them live, wow. I was a Rockpile fan for life. Yeah,
that would do it for me too, I think.
So yeah. I find this so interesting, your love of Nick Lowe and his songwriting, because then you worked with Carlene Carter.
Yes, his then wife. When Carlene came to Boston for the first time to play, somehow I got to open for her, not once, but twice at the Paradise Theater in Boston. And I was just like, she was just so sweet and so, she's just so nice. She still is. And then I decided I'm going to write a duet for us. And I did. Now, whether or not she was going to sing on it was another question. But then I said to Roger, hey, what are the chances of getting Carlene Carter on sing this duet? And he was like, I just call her. She'll love this. And that was that.
Give her a ring, yeah.
Yeah. And then I got to go to Nick Lowe, and I believe it was his studio, and I hope I haven't got this history wrong, but it was always like, we're going to Nick's London basement studio to put Carlene's vocals on here. And so that's what I always thought it was. Her daughter Tiffany was about 9 or 10, and I still have a recording of her trying to do her mother's part. And then she came back for the second album I recorded at Rockfield too. She just showed up at the studio and spent like a week there just hanging out and putting background vocals on stuff.
That's amazing.
That Rockfield Studios was a magical, magical place.
Oh, I imagine.
I had Paul Carrack on both those records because he, you know, it's like, oh, Paul Carrack's going to stop by. Oh, really? What? Can he play the B3 on that? Yeah, sure he will. I mean, I just didn't know that it worked like that. Like, twice, both years I was there recording, Robert Plant showed up. He was
no way.
The first time he was sitting in, like, there was a, everyone has their own apartment at Rockfield. It's a farm with, mm-hmm. you know, it's a real farm. And then there's like these like little like what you would call a townhouse today, apartments for all the musicians. And then a kitchen that belongs to everybody. And so it's my kitchen. I'm making my record. And I walk in and, sitting in my little restaurant booth. And he's like, oh, I hope you don't mind. I made myself some tea.
I'm like, how are you, mate? Yeah.
And I was like, no, I don't mind at all. I just said, why, what are you doing here? Are you working here? And he said, no, he explained to me that he'd been kicked out of his castle, which I guess was nearby. And, and that he kept all his clothes in road cases that were in the stables, because they had these empty stables in the courtyard, and that he came to pick up clothes. And the next year, just by chance, he showed up again. I challenged him. We had a ping pong table set up in like the biggest room of the studio, and I challenged him to a ping pong game. And I think we did the practice back and forth part, and then he was like, I can't. Nah, you know, and it was that.
We're both terrible, mate.
This must have been a surreal experience. You probably heard those Led Zeppelin songs on the radio millions of times in Massachusetts, right? And then here you are playing ping pong with the guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Led Zeppelin was a little on the, my older brother was, you know, that was like Led Zeppelin, whoa, this is heavy. He was into Jimi Hendrix and the Chambers Brothers, time has come today. And his records were definitely an influence on me as time went on. But I remember going, what the hell is this? I mean, the first song I ever heard by Led Zeppelin was the Lemon Song. And we were out in, like, my brother and I and some other people, we were on our camping trip, and we were out. It was in the winter. I don't know what
That's
we were
That's a weird
doing.
Place to hear
I know.
It.
We're in camping. We were in a camping trip, and it was and the thing that still freaks me out today about going out in the middle, hiking 3 miles where there's nobody and building a fire in the middle of the woods with your tents is you're showing everybody where you are. You're just saying, come on, kill us.
Right.
To this day, I cannot deal with camping.
Right.
But I do remember hearing that song for the first time around that campfire, and it kind of scared me. It scared me.
It would definitely scare me as well.
What's funny is the last time I ran into Robert Plant, because, you know, in Nashville, everyone just... No one bothers anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And the last time...
Bagels.
Yeah, the last time it was in a supermarket. It was in not even a supermarket. It was in a little mini market on Belmont Avenue. And then in Nashville, everybody does the head nod. Everybody goes like, yeah, I reckon. Mm-hmm, not going to say anything.
Mm-hmm. How you doing?
Yeah.
So this is great.
Robert Plant was buying AAA batteries. Just for the record. He ran out of AAA
batteries. What I was wondering when I started all this about being the Nashville insider is... how did you later on then make that transition from being the sort of Nashville company guy to go being this, you know, icon of DIY Nashville?
Because of my, I have three amazing, beautiful children. The first two born were Jake and Jamin. They, of course, the whole basement was instruments, and that's where I made up stuff, and I had my little studio there, and they started this band when they were 11 and 9, and that grew into a real band by the time they were like 13, 11, and there was another kid in there too who was 12, and they said, we have a band and we're going to play at Guido's Pizzeria
out by
and,
the airport,
we need you to drive us. And it was actually down by Vanderbilt. Wow. But it was an all ages place where they had a basement, like sort of like the original basement in Nashville, before Basement East, the original basement, tiny little basement. And then the parents could eat pizza upstairs when the kids played downstairs. And so I remember I was telling my wife about the band. I said, so the kids started a band and they're going to play Friday night at Guido's, and they've made all this merchandise. Like, they've already got pins, and they're hand screen printing these pieces of fabric that you sew onto your pants and your jacket and stuff. And they and she said, "What are they called?" And I said, "They're called the Sex." And she was like, "The Sex? No, I wait, wait a minute. They're 12. I mean, I said, well, I mean, because now there's other parents to consider. They're all bringing their kids." And I said, "Well, Jake explained it to me. It's not. He said, Dad, it has nothing to do with sex. It's about the sex, like the sex of a pygmy goat or a flower or a
like gender.
And then, gender. And and then they made t-shirts with a like a flower pot with someone watering it, and it said the sex. Well, but guess what? They sold tons of those to all their friends." So I think they were living by the idea that sex sells right from the beginning. And if you go on All Music Guide, they are still to this day the only band called
right?
The Sex.
That's interesting.
And they made the first Infinity Cat record because that's why we started Infinity Cat. So the Sex could they were like, "Let's start a record label so we can put out our records." And I was like, "Great." And all our friends too, they can put out their records. And I was like, "Sounds like something to do on the weekends." And then 20 years later, next year, 125 releases later, I never dreamed it would turn into what it turned into. But I was always led by Jake and Jamin. I had been in the music business for years and years and years. And when the Sex played at Guido's the first time, they asked me to record the show, and I used a little Sony stereo microphone in the back with a DAT machine. And they had the CD, which hadn't been recorded yet, on the merch table. And that was like $9. We'll send it to you. It's going to be a recording of this show. And that was ICR 001 was the Sex. At and it went from there.
Nice.
002 was Jeff. The first
Jeff.
Jeff
the Brotherhood. Yeah, totally.
But it wasn't called the Brotherhood yet. It was just called Jeff.
They were
Jake and Jamin, and they named their band as another brother, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
And then they made the Byzantine Empire and Castle Storm, three albums as Jeff. And then it became, that's when things had to be searchable by this point. And Jeff was not a searchable thing. And Jeff the Brotherhood
came out. Yeah, that's so true, though. Yeah.
So it sounds like, in a way, like your kids kind of showed you a new way to do things.
Absolutely
right?
Did. And they, not only did they show me a new way to do things, but I followed their path with, because I'd been through the horribleness of the music business already in so many ways.
Yeah.
Major label, major publishers, getting a welcome to the, let's make up a name, welcome to the CMI family, and then getting dropped. You know, it was just so, but they were like, "No, we're going to do it. This is how we do things." I always follow their lead. In 2008, they told me CDs were over. I was like, "What are we talking about? This CDs. Look, Dad, they're over. We need to go all vinyl. If you can make one at home, it's not special. You can't make vinyl at home." And 2008 is when we switched over to vinyl.
Smart.
Robert, I got to ask you, tell us something about Diarrhea Planet. I mean, one of the greatest guitar bands of all time. And I was actually thrown out of South by Southwest crowd surfing at a Diarrhea Planet show. So tell us about that band.
Let me tell you one thing that's the first thing I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
I always wonder what it felt like to crowd surf. And so I always thought the first time I should crowd surf would be at a Diarrhea Planet show.
Of course.
I mean, it's just like nuts. And
that's a place.
I knew I would never crowd surf at a Jeff the Brotherhood show because Dad doesn't need to be crowd surfing.
During Stop it, yeah. Dad. Yeah.
So I told, those kids, the six and Ian, the seven of them, just the nicest people in the world. which right. was a which was, by the way, a requirement to be on Infinity Cat. If you're going to be a knucklehead, we'll just say, hey, here's our little stupid right. contract. We're tearing it up, and here's all your stuff, and you yeah. go sell out your shows, because we don't want to deal with knuckleheads. But
no.
not for no a second were they ever knuckleheads.
Right.
But I don't know. I must have told one of them and at a Jeff the Brotherhood show at the Exit Inn, where Diary Planet opened, I was out in front like I always am because I went to all my kids' shows because they wanted me there. And not, right. I mean, it was, like, they were like, Dad, you're coming to the show, right? The other parents aren't invited. Well, we, you know, they expected me to be there. And I love going. And so they were playing, I don't know what song it was, but all of a sudden I felt this grip at the bottom of my thigh, back of yeah. my thigh. Mm-hmm. Three or four Diary Planet guys lifted me up into the air and then sent me around. And I was like, oh my God. And I started going toward the stage and I'm lying back like Kanye. I'm just like, to this day, I can't understand why everyone's kicking, but it's a kicking. Just lay there and relax. And I just floated around, and I remember at one point catching Jamin's eye as he's playing the drums, and he's looking at me, he's going, and I'm like, not my fault. and then I was gently let down to the ground as the song came to an end. And then that was my one and done on the sound. Wow. Now, back to Diary Planet. Jordan was lead singer, if you could have a lead singer, but he was the lead singer, but there's like sometimes four guys singing in yep. unison. He was an intern at Infinity Cat, as was Jenna Mitchell from Daddy Issues. And sometimes that's how we would hear the music. And yeah. He was playing stuff in the other room. And I'm like, what's this? Oh, this is our band we have at Belmont. It's kind of a joke. I'm like, well, no, but that's really good. And then, what's the name of the band? He said, Diarrhea Planet. And I was like, oh, no. No, that's not good. Well,
might want to change that.
It was supposed to be a joke. And so I said, well, first off, to me, that's the most disgusting word. For some reason, the word sounds coming out of your mouth like it looks to me. I don't know. I just hate that word. And I didn't say that word, and I didn't want to sign them. I said, you got to change your name. I suggested Die Planet, like Die Planet. That's still punk. Let's go, Die Planet. Like, we're going to kill you anyway with, you know, eventually global warming, we're going to kill you. But my son Jake said, Dad, they're, you know, opening for us at the Exit Inn on Friday. You got to come see them. Went and saw them. And when I go see a band, I'm, you know, in the mix. I'm right there. I'm 3 feet from the stage and try to be not in the middle of everyone bouncing back and forth, but, you know, sort of on the periphery. And I just went backstage afterwards and said, let's go. Let's do this, because it was so obvious that they were one of the greatest. I'm 66 years old. They're one of the greatest rock and roll live acts I have ever seen. Without any pyrotechnics and screens and dancers or nothing. They were just, and it's so funny when I say that to people my age, they're like, you're out of your mind. Who are you talking about? Diarrhea Planet. And it's like, well, did you go to the end and see a band?
Right.
Or did you just go to Bridgestone Arena?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. We're going to end it right there. And we're going to come back tomorrow, and you're going to hear more from Robert Ellis Orrell. And again, let me just mention the album is 467 Surf and Gun Club, and we really appreciate his time. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow's part two.
Yeah, exactly. We get a little bit wider in scope tomorrow, so I think you're going to enjoy that.
All right, let's move on to tomorrow's episode. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you all tomorrow.
then Jake later, like not even a half a year later, he started making a zine, and after telling me it had nothing to do with sex, he started a zine, and I said, "What are you calling your zine?" And he said, "I'm calling it my penis." And I said, "What?" And he's like, "It's called my penis." And I said, "Wait a minute, what are you talking about?" He said, "Well, have you seen how many zines there are? Like, if you saw one called My Penis, when you pick up and look at it?"